seeing eye. Dwyer was watching in horrified amazement, mixed with stunned pity, when that dark, jade-like eye abruptly exploded. The blinding flash was the last thing he clearly remembered for a long time to come. Part 7. The Book of the Sea. Do not make poisons that you cannot use. Use all of the poisons that you make. If others must clean up after you, do not act offended when they exact a price. The Scroll of Advice. Alvin's Tale.
So, there we were, just arrived at the top end tram platform after a long ride from Wufan Port, and no sooner do Huck, Pincer, and me step off the tram car, with little Hufu riding Pincer's shell for luck, then our Irish pal, Urron, gallops up all flushed and bothered. Without offering so much as a greeting preamble, she commences to prancing, snaking her narrow head back and forth, and hissing at us in that awful version of Gal, too, she must have picked up back when she was grub-sized, foraging in the grass out on the Warrell Plain. You know the dialect, I mean. The one that drops every other double-click phrase stop. So, at first, all I could make out was a bunch of basso-tone pulses conveying frenzied excitement. Worse, a moment later she starts nipping at us like we're a bunch of pack donkeys to be herded down the hall. "Hrum! Now hold it right there," I insisted. "Nothing ever gets done right by letting yourself get so igsy frantic. Whatever you've got to say can surely wait for a proper hello to friends you haven't seen in weeks. After all, yee-ho-wong-wa!" Yes, that was a hoonish throat blad of pain. Huck had rolled one of her main wheels over my left foot.
"Varnish it, Alvin. You sound just like your father."
My father, I thought. How utterly ungloss.
"Haven't you been listening to Urron?"
Huck went on. My sack panted a few times as I ran back over the last few duras, piecing together some of what Urron was nattering about. It was a wild tale, all right, and we've told each other some whoppers.
"Hrrr! A starship?" I stared at our Irish pal.
"You mean it this time? It's not just a comet, like you tried fooling us with a year ago?" Urron stamped a forefoot, knowing I had her nailed. Switching to Anglic, she swore,
"This time for real, believe me, I heard you yelling geese talking. They caught it on plates."
"On plates," I translated from the way her cleft upper lip mangles some Anglic consonants. Photographic plates. Maybe Urron wasn't having us on after all. "Can we see?" I asked. An Irish moan of frustration.
"You cheeky file of scales and fur. That's where I've been trying to take you guys since the trans-stuffed."
"Oh," I bowed with a sweep of one arm. "Well, then, what are we waiting around here for? Let's go!" Years ago, Uriel the Smith inherited the Mount Gwen works from Urtana, who was liege heir to Ulenku, who got the sprawling underground mill from her own dying master, the great Ernunu, who rebuilt those mighty halls after quake shook the slope like a wet noor during the year of the egg. Before that, the tale goes back to a misty time before humans brought paper memory to Jijo, when wisdom had to fit in someone's living head, or else be lost.
back to days when Irish settlers had to fight and prove themselves more than mere galloping savages, roaming the grassy plains, beholden to high-caste Cowans for everything they owned. Euron used to recite the legend during our adventure trips, even allowing for exaggeration. Those must have been brave Urs who climbed fuming volcano heights to build the first crude forges near fiery lava springs, toiling through cinders and constant danger to learn the secret of reworking Buyer metal and break the Grey Queen's tool monopoly forever. It kind of makes you glad humans didn't come any sooner, 'cause the answers would have been right there in some book. How to make knives and lenses and windows and such. Sure, it would have made it easier for the other exile races to free themselves from dominion by Cowanish woodcarvers. On the other hand, all you have to do is hear Euron's lisping tale to know what pride her folk won from all that work and sacrifice. They did it themselves, you see, earning liberty and self-respect. Ask any hoon how we'd feel without our swaying ships. Earthling lore has made improvements, but no one gave us the sea. Not our far-off Gutatsa patrons, or the Great Galactic Library, or our selfish ancestors who dumped us on Jijo, naive and unready. It's a proud thing to have done it for ourselves. Pride can be important when you don't have much else. Before entering the Forge Inferno, Pincertip draped a water-soaked mantle over his soft red carapace. I gathered my cloak around me, while Huck checked her goggles and axle guards. Then Euron led us past overlapping leather curtains into the works. We hurried along a walkway of treated boo, hung between bubbling pools that glowed white with Jijo's blood heat. Cleverly diverted updrafts guided smoldering vapors into stone baffles, venting them outside to look no different than any other smoker on Mount Gwen's flank. Huge buckets dangled overhead, one filled with reclaimed Buyer scrap and the other with a sandy mix, each waiting to be dipped into that blazing heat, then poured into clay molds. Irish workers hauled pulleys and ladles. Another twirled a big glob of liquid glass at the end of a tube, spinning it round and round to form a flat whirling disk that turned solid as it thinned and cooled. A window destined for homes far away from here. They were assisted by several gray Cowans who, in one of Jijo's ironies, turned out to be the other sept well-suited to these conditions. The Greys may even be happier than when their queens used to dominate the commons, but I never could read much expression on their stony cupolas. I often wonder how our wild emotional pincer could be related to them. Farther from the heat, half a dozen gekeks skittered across the smooth floor, handling account ledgers, while a Treyiki specialist with throbbing synthy rings tasted each mix to certify the mill's products would rust or decay in less than 200 years, as required by the sages. Some orthodox scroll-pounders say we shouldn't have smithies at all, that they're vanities distracting us from salvation through forgetfulness. But I think the place is gloss, even if the smoke frets my throat sacs and sets my spine scales itching. Euron led us through more curtains into the laboratory grotto, where Uriel studies the secrets of her art, both those hard won by her ancestors and others delved from human texts. Clever breezes freshened the air, allowing us to loosen our protections. Pincer gratefully doffed his heavy mantle and doused his red carapace at a shower alcove. Hufu splashed eagerly while I sponged my sack. Euron kept her distance from the water, preferring a brief roll in some clean, dry sand. Huck skittered down a hallway lined with many doors, peering into various laboratory chambers.
"Alvin,"
she whispered urgently, waving me over with one arm and two eye stalks.
"Come, look. Care to guess who's here again?"
"Who is it?"
Pincer whistled, leaving five wet trails of prints behind him. Euron daintily avoided the moist tracks with her rattling hooves. I already had a pretty good idea who Huck was talking about, since no ship passenger enters Wufon without being known to the harbor master. My mother. She hadn't announced anything, but I knew from overheard snatches that the latest draw ship had brought an important human visitor, one who debarked at night, heading straight to the Mount Gwen tram.
"Hrum! I'll bet you a sweet bouquet it's that sage again," I ventured before arriving at the door. "The one from Byblos."
Huck's rear-facing eye looked disappointed, and she groused,
"Lucky guess,"
while making space for the rest of us. "I knew this room. Many's the previous visit I used to stand at the doorway and stare at the goings-on within. The huge chamber held Uriel's mystery machine, a gimcrackery of gears, cables, and revolving glass that seemed to fill the vaulted cavern with grinding motion, and like one of those Victorian factories you read about in books by Dickens. Only this device didn't make a single blessed thing, as far as any of us could ever tell. Only countless glitters of light as whirling crystal disks spun like hundreds of ghostly little gekeks, rolling against each other madly, futilely, going no place the faster they spun. I glimpsed the human visitor bent over a trestle table with a precious-looking folio spread open before him, pointing at a diagram, while Uriel rocked in a circle, lifting one leg at a time, shaking her pelted head in disagreement. The smith's gray-fringed nostril blew exasperation.
"With all due respect, Sage Fyrovsky, you might have gone to gathering instead of conning all this way. I cannot see how this vuk is relevant to our problem, to our quandary."
The human wore the black cloak of a lesser sage, the kind who dwell in the sacred halls of Byblos with half a million printed tomes for company, tending wisdom handed down for 300 years. He was hoonish handsome, which happens when one of their males gets gray head fleece and lets his facial fur grow long, an effect enhanced by a noble long nose. This worthy jabbed again at the ancient page, so hard I feared he'd hurt the priceless text.
"But I tell you, this algorithm is exactly what you need. It can be executed in a tenth the space, with far fewer parts, if you just consider."
I can't write what followed, because it was in that dialect of Anglic called engineering, and even my hoonish memory won't help me write words I can't understand or spell. The sage must have come to help Uriel in her project. Anyone who knew her could predict Uriel's resistance. Beyond those two, we saw Erdonal, a younger Urish techie, who the master trusted with general upkeep of this whatever-it-is machine, stretching beyond the farthest reach of the single overhead skylight. Erdonal peered through the shuddering, squeaking assembly, reaching in to tighten an elastic belt or lubricate a bearing. As senior apprentice, she was two hooves toward being Uriel's heir. The sole other candidate was Euron, partly because of our pal's school scores, and also because she's the nearest of Uriel's scent cousins to survive from step-grub to adult. No doubt Erdonal worked here, tending the master's personal project,
to improve her chances, though she certainly hated the big machine. Miniature centaur figures moved amid the whirling disks, making delicate adjustments. Urish males, normally rare to see outside their wives' pouches, tightened belts and gears under Erdonald's terse direction. Striking a blow for equality, I guess. I bent and whispered to Huck, "So much for all that talk about starships. If they really saw one, they wouldn't be fooling with toy gadgets right now." Euron must have overheard me. She swung her long muzzle, wearing a wounded look. 2 out of 3 eyes narrowed.
"I heard Uriel and Giffiz," she hissed. "Anyhow, what does a snarty fence like you know?"
"Enough to know that all these whirling glass yo-yos don't have hair on a Kellen's backside to do with visiting spaceships." Even if we hadn't been snapping at each other, it wasn't easy for a gang like ours to peer discreetly into a room, the way you read about humans doing in detective stories. Still, those inside mightn't have noticed us if Hufu the Nor hadn't chosen that moment to go bounding in, yipping at those spinning pulleys and disks. Before we knew it, she leaped onto a leather belt and was running in place like mad, snapping toward a pair of cringing Ur's husbands. Erdonald noticed, waving her arms, displaying the bright glands under both brood pouches.
"This event signifies, it signifies,"
the apprentice demanded with slurred interrogative trills. Her agitation grew as the master snaked a grizzled snout around to peer at the commotion. Despite stereotypes, a hoon can act quickly if he sees a clear need. I rushed over to snatch Hufu, rumbling my very best umble, and rejoined the others, girding for a group tongue-lashing.
"Behavior that is astonishingly, horrifyingly unacceptable," declared Erdonald in Gal, too. "Interruption of an important congress by knavish, microcephalic, unhousebroken,"
Uriel cut in, breaking Erdonald's insult stream before the fuming, stamping Euron could be provoked to responding in kind.
"That will do, Erdonald,"
the master commanded in Gal 7.
"Kindly take the youngsters to Gibiz, who has business of Ur's own with them, then hurry back. We have several more models to run before we are through for the day." "It shall be done,"
Erdonald replied in the same tongue. Turning to us with an aggressive neck stretch, the older apprentice said,
"Come along, you gaggle of jeeky adventurers."
She said it with dripping scorn, which is possible in Gal 7, though not as harsh as Anglic.
"Come swiftly. It's been decided to take you up on your offer. Your grand plan, your one-way expedition to hell."
Part 8. The Book of the Slope. Legends. It is said that glaivers are an example to us all. Of the 7 races to plant exile colonies on the slope, they alone have escaped this prison where their ancestors consigned them. They did this by finding and traveling the path of redemption. Now they are innocents, no longer criminals, having become one with Jijo. In time, they may even be renewed, winning that blessed rarity, a second chance at the stars. It is a source of some frustration to Earthlings, the youngest sept to come here, that humans never got to meet Glaivers as thinking, speaking beings. Even the Hoon and Urs arrived too late to know them at their prime, when Glaivers were said to have been mighty intellects, with a talent for deep race memory. Watching their descendants root through our garbage middens, it is hard to picture the race as great starfarers and the patrons of three noble client lines. What desperation brought them here to seek safety in oblivion? The Gekeks tell us, by oral tradition, that it was the result of financial setbacks. Once, according to Gekek lore, Glaivers were said to be among those rare breeds with a knack for conversing with Zhang, the hydrogen-breathing civilization existing aloofly in parallel to the society of races that use oxygen. This aptitude enabled Glaivers to act as intermediaries, bringing them great wealth and prestige, until a single contractual mistake reversed their fortunes, landing them in terrible debt. It is said that the great Zhang are patient. The debt falls due in several hundred thousand years. Yet so deep is the usury that the Glaiver race and all its beloved clients were hopelessly forfeit. Glaivers had but one thing left to trade, a precious thing they might yet sell, providing they could find the right path. That thing was themselves. Collected Fables of Jijo 7, 3rd Edition, Department of Folklore and Language, Byblos, Year 1867 of Exile. Asks. The plunder ship soon departed as it came, amid a storm of whirling fragments of our poor shattered forest. A tornado leaned in its wake, as if Jijo's own ghostly hand were reaching, clasping, trying to restrain it. Alas, this departure was no cause for joy, for the crew vowed an early return. Surety of this promise squatted near the steaming scar where the ship had lain, a black cube, half an arrow flight wide, featureless save where a ramp led to a gaping hatch. Nearby, two frail cloth pavilions had been transplanted from gathering, at the request of star gods who had stayed behind when their ship departed. One to serve as a place of liaison, and a large tent for examining specimens. Already a small foray party of star humans worked under that canopy, feeding dark, mysterious machines with samples of Jijoan life. Shock still throbbed throughout the commons. Despite unity entreaties by their sages, the many septs and clans cleaved, each seeking shelter among its own kind. Emissaries darted among these cloistered groups, parleying in hushed secrecy. All save the youngest of the six, whose envoys were rebuffed. For the moment, no one, not even the Treiki, wants to speak to humans. Sarah. Around mid-afternoon, the river spilled into canyon country. As if remembering some urgent errand, the water hastened through a terrain of thorny scrub, clinging to eroded slopes. Sarah recalled these badlands from childhood fossil hunting trips with Dwyer and Lark. Those had been good times, despite the heat, stale food and gritty dust, especially when Melina used to come along before the final lingering illness that took her away, leaving Nello an old man. Their mother's soft accent used to grow stronger, Sarah recalled, the farther south they traveled. The open sky never seemed to cause her any dread. In contrast, the crew of the Haupowa grew restless with each southward league, especially after the morning's episode of inept piracy by the shattered bridge. Clearly, the Hoon sailors would prefer tying up for the rest of the day under some rocky shelter. The captain reminded them, with a farty blat from his violet sack, that this was no leisurely dross run, but an urgent mission for the commons. A prevailing west wind normally filled the sails of craft climbing upstream. In places where the river's current pushed strongest, trusty Hoon operators offered winch tows from cleverly camouflaged windmills, shaped like upright egg beaters, that tapped the funneled breeze under cliff overhangs. But the first set of lonely vanes swept in and out of sight before anyone could emerge from the attached hut to answer their hails, and half a midura later, the overseer of the next windmill barely finished a rumbling courtesy preamble before the river hauled the Haupowa beyond range. Like the tug of time, Sarah thought, pulling you into the future before you're ready, leaving behind a wake of regrets. If only life lets you catch a friendly tow rope now and then to climb back into the past, offering a chance to change the flow of your own life stream. What would she do with the last year or two to live over again? Could any amount of foresight have averted the sweet pain of giving her heart where it did not belong? Even with foreknowledge of Joshu's nature, would or could she have rejected in advance all those months of heady joy when she had pretended in her own mind that he could be hers alone? Might any amount of prophecy have helped save his life? An image came to her, unbeckoned and unwelcome, out of memory. Recollection of the very day she fled Byblos Citadel, clutching her books and charts, rushing home to that treehouse overlooking Dolo Dam, to drown herself in study. Black banners, flapping in a zephyr that blew past the castle's heavy roof of stone. Murmur kites, tugging at their tether strings, moaning their warbling lament during the mulching ceremony for Joshu and the other plague victims. A tall, fair-skinned woman, newly come by boat from far-off Ovoom town, standing by Joshu's bier, performing a wife's duty, laying on his brow the wriggling torus that would turn mortal flesh into gleaming crystal dust. The poised, cool face of Sage Tane, rimmed by a mane of hair like buoyer steel, approaching to graciously forgive Sarah's year-long indiscretion. Her fling with a mere bookbinder, renewing his offer of a more seemly union. Her last sight of Byblos, the high walls, the gleaming libraries, with forest-topped stone overhead. A part of her life, coming to an end, as surely as if she had died. "The past is a bitter place," said the scrolls. "Only the path of forgetfulness leads ultimately to redemption." A sharp, horrified gasp was followed by a clatter and crash of fallen porcelain.
"Miss Sarah," an aspirated voice called. "Come quickly, please, all of you."
She hurried from the starboard rail to find Pizora puffing in agitation, Ur's delicate arms of manipulation reaching out imploringly. Sarah's heart leaped when she saw the stranger's pallet empty, blankets thrown in disarray. She spied him, back between three barrel caskets of human dross, clutching a jagged pottery shard. The wounded man's eyes gaped wide and wild, staring at the Traiki pharmacist. "He's terrified of Pizora," she realized. "But why?" "Do not fear," she said soothingly in Gal 7, stepping forward slowly. "Fear is inappropriate at this time." Eyes showing white above the irises, his gaze swung from her to Pizora, as if unable to picture the two of them in the same frame, the same thought. Sarah switched to Anglic, since some coastal human settlements used it almost exclusively. "It's all right. It is. Really, you're safe. You've been hurt, terribly hurt, but you're getting better now. Really, you're safe." Some words prompted more reaction than others. He seemed to like safe, so she repeated it while holding out her hand. The stranger glanced anxiously at Pizora. Sarah moved to block his view of the Traigi, and some tension diminished. His eyes narrowed, focusing on her face. Finally, with a resigned sigh, he let the jagged sliver fall from trembling fingers. "That's good," she told him. "No one's going to harm you." Though the initial flood of panic was over, the stranger kept glancing toward the Dolo village pharmacist, shaking his head with surprise and evident loathing.
"Bedamned! Bedamned! Bedamned!"
"Now be polite," she chided, while sliding a folded blanket behind his head. "You wouldn't be taking a nice boat trip to Tarricktown without Pizora's unguents. Anyway, why should you be afraid of a Traiki? Whoever heard of such a thing?" He paused, blinked at her twice, then commenced another pathetic attempt to speak.
Jove.
Frustrated, the stranger abruptly stopped stammering and shut his mouth, squeezing his lips in a tight, flat line. His left hand raised halfway to the side of his head toward the bandage covering his horrible wound, then stopped just short, as if touching would make his worst fears real. The arm dropped, and he sighed, a low, tremulous sound. "Well, he's awake, at least," Sarah thought, contemplating a miracle. "Alert and no longer feverish." The commotion attracted gawkers. Sarah called for them to move back. If a Traiki could set off hysteria in the wounded man, what about the sight of a Kellenish male with sharp, clambering spikes up and down each leg? Even these days, there were humans who disliked having other members of the Six close by. So the next sound was the last thing Sarah expected to hear. Laughter. The stranger sat up, eyeing the gathered passengers and crew. He gaped at Joma, the Explosor's son, who had climbed Blade's broad back, clasping the head cupola jutting from the Kewan's blue carapace. Blade had always been gentle and popular with the kids of Dolo, so Sarah thought little of it. But the stranger sucked breath, pointed, and guffawed. He turned and saw a sailor feeling tidbits to a favorite Noor, while another hoon patiently let Pretty, the chimpanzee, perch on his broad shoulder for a better view. The stranger let out a dry, disbelieving cackle. He blinked in puzzled surprise at the sight of the Gekek scriven dancer Fakun, who had spun over to rest wheels between Pizora and the Urish tinker Ulgor. Fakun ogled the injured human with a pair of waving eye stalks, turning the other two toward his neighbors as if to ask, "What's going on?" The stranger clapped hands like a delighted child, laughing uproariously as tears flowed tributaries down his dark, haggard cheeks. Asks.
It was as if a century's enlightenment by our holy egg and all the earlier hard work to establish the commons were forgotten in the aftermath. Few rauk could be seen anywhere, as suspicion poisons drove them off our brows to sulk in moss-lined pouches, leaving us to rely on mere words, as we had done in ages past, when mere words often led to war. Our own folk brought samples of recent noxious rumors, and I laid our base segment over upon the vileness, letting its vapors rise up our central core, bringing distasteful understanding of these odious thoughts. Our human neighbors are not trustworthy any more, if they ever were. They will sell us out to their gene and clan cousins in the foray party. They lied with their colorful tale of being poor patronless wolflings scorned among the five galaxies. They only feigned exile while spying on us and this world. Even more bitter was this gossipy slander. They will depart soon with their cousins, climbing to resume the godlike life our ancestors forsook, leaving us to molder in this low place, cursed, forgotten, while they roam galaxies. That was the foulest chattering stench, so repugnant that we vented a noisome, melancholy steam. The humans! Might they really do that? Might they abandon us? If, when that happened, night would grow as loathsome as day, for we would ever have to look up through our darkness and see what they had reclaimed. The stars.
Lark. The forayer biologist made him nervous. Ling had a way of looking at Lark, one that kept him befuddled, feeling like a savage or a child, which he was, in comparison, despite being older in duration years. For one thing, all his lifetime of study wouldn't fill even one of the crystal memory slivers she dropped blithely into the portable console slung over her one-piece green coverall. The dark woman's exotic high cheekbones framed large eyes, a startling shade of creamy brown.
"Are you ready, Lark?"
she asked. His own pack held 4 days' rations, so there'd be no need to hunt or forage. But this time he would leave behind his precious microscope. That treasure of Urish artifice now seemed a blurry toy next to the gadgets Ling and her comrades used to inspect organisms down to the level of their constituent molecules. What could we tell them that they don't already know? He pondered. What could they possibly want from us? It was a popular question, debated by those friends who would still speak to him, and by those who turned their backs on any human for being related to invaders. Yet the sages charged a human and a heretic at that, to guide one of these thieves through a forest filled with treasure, to begin the dance of negotiating for our lives. The six had one thing to offer, something missing from the official Galactic Library entry on Jijo, collated by the Buyer before they departed. That thing was recent data about how the planet had changed after a few million fallow years. On that, Lark was as expert as a local savage could be.
"Yes, I'm ready," he told the woman from the starship.
"Good, then let's be off." She motioned for him to lead. Lark hoisted his pack and turned to show the way out of the valley of crushed trees by a route passing far from the cleft of the egg. Not that anyone expected its existence to stay secret. Robot scouts had been out for days, nosing through the glens, streams, and fumaroles. Still, there was a chance they might mistake the egg for just another rock formation. That is, until it next started to sing. Lark's chosen path also led away from the canyon where the innocents had been sent. The children, chimpanzees, Lorniks, Zookirs, and Glavers. Perhaps the plunderer's eyes weren't omniscient after all. Maybe precious things could be hidden. Lark agreed with the sage's plan. Thus far. Clots of spectators normally gathered at the valley rim to watch the black cube drink sunlight without reflections or highlights. When the two humans reached those heights, one group of Urish onlookers backed away nervously, hooves clattering like pebbles on hard stone. They were all young, unbrooded females with empty mate pouches, just the sort to have an itch for trouble. Conical heads bobbed and hissed, lowering toward the humans, displaying triangles of serrated teeth. Lark's shoulders tensed. The rauk in his belt pocket squirmed as it sensed rancor in the air.
"Stop that," he warned, when Ling started pointing an instrument toward the milling Urs. "Just keep walking."
"Why? I only want to take—"
"Of that I'm sure, but now's not a good time."
Lark held her elbow, urging her along. From first contact, he could tell she was quite strong. A rock shot past them from behind and struck the ground ahead. An aspirated shout followed.
"Skrulls!"
Ling started to turn in curiosity, but Lark kept her moving. Added voices joined in.
"Skrulls! Cheeky skrulls!"
More stones pelted around them. Ling's eyes showed dawning concern, so Lark reassured her dryly.
"Urs don't throw very well. Lousy aim, even after they learned about bows and arrows."
"They are your enemies," she observed, quickening the pace on her own accord.
"That's putting it too strong. Let's just say that humans had to fight a bit for our place here on Jijo, early on."
The Urish rabble followed, easily keeping up, shouting and stoking their nerve, until one of their own kind galloped in from the east, swerving suddenly in front of the throng. Wearing the brassard of a proctor of gathering, she spread her arms wide, displaying two full mating pouches and active scent glands. The mob stumbled to a halt as her head bobbed bold, aggressive circles, snapping and shooing them away from the two humans.
"Law and order still function," Lark thought with relief. "Though for how much longer?"
"What were they shouting at us?" Ling asked after marching farther under a canopy of fine-needled vor trees.
"It wasn't in Gal 6 or Gal 2.
"Local dialect," Lark chuckled. "Jeeky was originally a Hoonish curse word, now in common use. It means smelly,
as if those randy little unwed urs should talk. And the other word? Lark glanced at her. Insults are important to urs. Back in pioneer days, they wanted something to call us, something humans would find both offensive and apropos. So, during an early truce, they very nicely asked our founders to tell them the name of an animal familiar to us, one that lived in trees and was known for being silly. Her eyes, taken straight on, were large and exquisite, hardly the sort you'd expect on a pirate.
"I don't get it," Ling said.
"To them, we're tree climbers, just as they must have reminded our ancestors of horses, hinnies, grass browsers."
"So? I still don't."
"So, we make an effort to act really insulted when an angry urs calls one of us a squirrel. It makes them so happy, you see." She looked puzzled, as if many parts of his explanation confused her.
"You want to please your enemies?" she asked.
Lark sighed. "No one on the slope has enemies anymore, not on that kind of scale." "That is, not until lately," he added silently. "Why?" he continued, trying to turn the interrogation around. "Are enemies common where you're from?" It was her turn to sigh. "The galaxies are dangerous. Humans aren't well liked by many." "So said our ancestors. It's because humans are wolflings, right? Because we uplifted ourselves without the help of a patron?" Ling laughed.
"Oh, that old myth."
Lark stared.
"But do you can't mean
that we know the truth, our origin and destiny?" She smiled, an expression of serene knowing.
"Goodness, lost child of the past, you people have been away a long time.
Do you mean that you never heard of our gracious lords the Rothan, the beloved patrons of all humankind?" His foot caught a stone, and Ling grabbed his arm to steady him.
"But we can discuss that later. First, I want to talk about these, what did you call them, skurls?"
She held out a finger adorned with a bulbous ring Lark guessed must be a recording device. It took an effort of will to switch mental tracks, suppressing his flare of curiosity about galactic issues.
"What?
Oh, that's squirrels."
"You imply they are arboreal and human-like. Will we get to see any along the way?"
He blinked at her, then shook his head.
I don't think so. Not this trip." "Well, what can you tell me about them? For instance, do they show any aptitude for tool use?"
Lark needed neither sigh nor rauk to read the mind of his lovely guest. He carried her question toward its unmistakable aim. "Do they show a talent for machinery, for war and commerce, for philosophy and art? Do they have potential, the magic essence that it takes to profit from the right kind of help? Do they have the rare tincture, the promise that makes a patron's push worthwhile, the stuff to become starfarers someday? Are they prospects for uplift?" Lark concealed his surprise over her ignorance.
"Not to the best of my knowledge," he answered honestly.
Since the only squirrels he'd seen were in ancient faded pictures from old Earth.
"If we pass near any, you can see for yourself."
Clearly, the star forayers were here seeking bio-treasure. What else might poor Jijo offer that was worth sneaking past the sentries of the Migration Institute, slipping through star lanes long ceded to the strange, menacing civilization of the Zhang, then braving Ismanuti's deadly carbon wind. What else? Lark pondered. Except refuge. Ask your own ancestors, boy. The newcomers made no pretense, as Lark might have expected, of representing a galactic agency or feigning a legal right to survey Jijo's biosphere. Did they think the exiles had no memory of such things, or did they simply not care? Their goal, data about changes since the Boyer left, made Lark's life work more precious than he ever imagined. So much that Lester Campbell had ordered him to leave his notebooks behind, lest they fall into alien hands. "The sages want me to play it close, try to find out at least as much as from her as she learns from me." A foredoomed plan, of course. The six were like infants, ignorant of the rules of a deadly game. Still, Lark would do his best, so long as his agenda and the sages remained the same, which might not always be the case. "They know that. Surely they have not forgotten I'm a heretic." Fortunately, the forayers had assigned their least intimidating member to accompany him. It might just as easily have been Ron, a huge male with close-cropped gray hair, a booming voice, and a wedge-like torso that seemed about to burst from his snug uniform. Of the two others who emerged from the black station, Kuhn was nearly as masculinely imposing as Ron, with shoulders like a young hoon's, while pear-haired Besh was so dramatically female that Lark wondered how she moved so gracefully with a body that prodigiously curved. Compared to her colleagues, Ling seemed almost normal, though she would have caused a stir growing up in any Jijoan town, no doubt provoking many duels among hot-tempered suitors. "Don't forget your vow," Lark reminded himself, puffing in exertion while climbing a steep part of the trail. Perspiration stained the front of Ling's blouse, which clung to her in provocative ways. He forced himself to look away. "You made a choice to live for a goal greater than yourself. If you wouldn't forsake that aim for an honest woman on Jijo, don't even think about giving it up for a raider, an alien, an enemy of this world." Lark found a new way to direct the heat in his veins. Lust can be blocked by other strong emotions, so he turned to anger. "You plan to use us," he mused silently. "But things may turn out different than you think." That attitude, in turn, roused an obstinate layer, overcoming his natural curiosity. Earlier, Ling had said something about humans no longer being considered wolflings out among the stars, no longer orphans without patrons to guide them. From the look in her eye, she had clearly expected this news to cause a stir. No doubt she wanted him to beg for further information. "I'll beg if I must, but I'd rather buy, borrow, or steal it. We'll see. The game's just in its opening rounds." Soon they passed stands of lesser boo. Ling took samples of some segmented stems, each no more than 10 centimeters across, deftly slicing near-transparent sections into her analyzer. "I may be a dumb native guide," he commented, "but I'll wager Boo doesn't show much sign of presapience." Her head jerked when he said the word. Thus, Lark ended one pretense. "We know why you're here." Ling's dusky skin did not hide a flush. "Did I suggest any such thing? I just want to track genetic drift, since this species was planted by the Boyer. We'll need a benchmark to compare trends in animals, that's all." "So we begin the outright lies," he thought. From fossil evidence, Lark knew that Bu already thrived on Jijo long before the Buyer won their lease 20 million years ago. Perhaps it was imported by a previous tenant. Whole ecosystems had co-evolved around the successful vegetal type, and countless animals now relied on it. But things must have been rough for the first eon or so, as Bu pushed native flora out of many watersheds. Lark knew little about the biochemical level, but from fossils he was sure the genus hadn't changed much in 100 million years. Why would she lie about something so unimportant? The scrolls taught that deceit was not only wrong, but also a fickle, dangerous ally, and habit-forming. Once you start lying, it's hard to stop. Eventually, it is small, needless lies that get you caught. "Speaking of pre-sapience," Ling said, folding her sample case, "I can't help wondering where you folks stashed your chimpanzees. I'm sure they must have drifted in interesting ways." It was Lark's turn to give away too much with an involuntary twitch. Denial was useless. Humans don't need Rauk to play this game with each other, reading clues in each other's faces. Lester must know I'll betray as much as I learn. "Chimps are like children. Naturally, we sent them away from possible danger." Ling looked left and right. "Do you see any danger?" Lark almost burst out with sardonic laughter. In Ling's eyes danced a complexity of things he could only guess, but some thoughts were clear without being spoken aloud. "You know that I know. I know that you know that I know. And you know that you know that I know." There is another emotion that can overcome hormonal lust or the fury of anger. Respect. He nodded to his adversary, meeting her gaze full on. "I'll let you know if we pass near any chimps, so you can see for yourself." Ling had extremely sharp vision, and proved it frequently by spotting movements Lark would have missed. Forest creatures foraging, browsing, hunting, or tending their young. In this, she reminded him of Dwar. But Ling also owned many tools, which she brought swiftly to bear on whatever crawling, flitting, or ambling thing caught her attention. She must really have studied those old Buyer records, for their progress was slowed by frequent sighs of recognition when she would classify a species of shrub, tree, or four-winged bird, then ask Lark to add whatever quaint name the locals used. Lark gave cautious answers, just enough to support his value as a local expert. Sometimes Ling would pause and mutter into her ring, as if contemplating what she had learned. Lark realized with a shiver that she must be in contact with her base. This was speech at a distance, not like semaphore, far-casting, or even rare psi telepathy, but the high-tech kind mentioned in books, perfect and reliable. The voice of the person at the other end could barely be made out as a whisper. He guessed it must be projected somehow, compactly, to the region near her ear. At one point, Ling murmured in a dialect form of Anglic, rather hard to follow.
"Yeah, yeah. All right. I'll try to speak up. Be you got it, just distance ear detail."
The other party must have been persuasive, for Ling picked up the pace when the march resumed, until the next excited discovery caused her to forget her promise and go right back to dawdling over some intriguing detail. Lark found this character flaw, how easily she was distracted by the sight of living things, the first thing he honestly liked about her. Then Ling spoiled it by patronizing him, defining, in slow, simple words, what nocturnal meant. Lark quashed resentment. He had read enough adventure novels as a kid to know how a native guide was supposed to act, so he thanked her respectfully. There might be future advantages to be had in letting her maintain her stereotypes. For all of Ling's enthusiasm and keen eyesight, she was no hunter like Dwyer. Even to Lark, the surroundings frothed with signs, footprints and broken stems, feces and territory marks, wisps of fur, scale, feather, and torg. Any child of the six could read such stories found along the path. But Ling seemed aware only of what was currently alive. Thinking about Dwyer made Lark smile. By the time he gets back from his mundane glaver hunt, I'll be the one with wild stories to tell for a change. At intervals, Ling unfolded an instrument with twin holio screens, one showing a forest scene that rippled and moved as Lark stared over her shoulder, showing some place nearby he could tell from the foliage. The other screen displayed charts and figures he found indecipherable, which was humbling. He had read nearly every biology text in Byblos, and figured he should at least understand the vocabulary. Maybe the Yes Bwana routine isn't such an act. Turns out I may be illiterate after all. Ling explained this was data from one of the robot probes, climbing the same path some distance ahead. "Could we move faster now?" she asked eagerly. "The robot has subdued some interesting specimens. I want to reach them before they deteriorate." She had been the one dawdling. Still, Lark only nodded. "Whatever you say." The first specimen was a hapless wuwonk worm, whose burrow had been sliced open with scalpel smoothness. A web of fibrous stuff defied repeated battering by the worm's bony head as it fought futilely to escape. Ling spoke into her ring. "This feral form seems related to ore gleaners, the Bwyer imported from Desni 3 eons ago. Desni evolved organisms should estivate after injection with clathrate of methane. We'll try a larger dose now." She aimed a device that sent a slender tube flashing like a resolute predator, piercing a crease between two armor plates. The worm flinched, then slumped, quivering. "Good. Now, let's see if encephalization has changed during the last mega-year." She turned to Lark and explained, "That's to see if they have more brain matter." "Now that I knew," he thought, but restrained himself and remarked instead, "How perfectly amazing." Lark learned to pass instruments, draw blood, and assist his employer as required. At one point, the raspy tongue of an angry long snout whipped between the strands of its cage and would have torn strips off Ling's arm if he had not yanked it away in time. After that, Ling seemed to realize her native guide had uses beyond toting, carrying, and being impressed whenever she spoke. Though the robot specimens were brainy types, living by their wits as hunters or omnivorous gatherers, Lark thought none of them likely prospects for uplift. "Maybe in 10 million years, when this galaxy is reopened for legal settlement. By then, long snouts or leap raptors may be ready, tested by evolution, and if needs luck, primed for adoption by some kindly elder race." Yet, watching her use sorcerous rays and probes to appraise a mangy-looking carrion snorter, Lark could not help but imagine the beast responding by rearing up on its hind legs and reciting an ode to the comradeship of living things. Ling's group clearly thought they might find something precious emerging on Jijo ahead of schedule. Once potential is there, all it takes is help from a patron to set a new race on the upward path. A few texts in Byblos disagreed. A birth does not always need a midwife, they claimed. Lark chose to follow up that idea during the next part of the trek. A while back, you implied Earthlings aren't known as Wolflings anymore. Ling smiled enigmatically.
Some still believe that old myth, but others have known the truth for quite a while.
The truth?
About where we came from, who gave humanity the boon of thought and reason, our true patrons. The Rothan mentors and guides, we owe everything we are and ever will be.
Lark's heart beat faster. A few tomes on the subject had survived the fire that ravaged the Byblos xenology shelves, so he knew the debate was still raging when the sneak ship Tabernacle left for Jijo 3 centuries ago. In those days, some speculated that humanity had been helped, in secret, by clandestine benefactors, long before the historical era. Others held out for the model of Darwin, that intelligence could evolve all by itself, without outside help, despite the skepticism of galactic science. Now, Ling insisted the debate was settled.
"Who are they?"
Lark asked in a hushed voice.
"Did some Rothan come to Jijo with you?"
That smile returned, a knowing look tugging her high cheekbones.
"Truth for truth. First, you tell me the real story. What's a pack of humans doing here on this dreary little world?"
Which pack are you talking about, yours or mine?" Her silent smile was his only answer, as if to say,
"Go ahead and be coy. I can wait."
Ling followed tracers left by the relentless robot, leading from one sedated creature to the next. As the day waned, she picked up the pace until they reached the crest of a long ridge. From there, Lark saw several more plateaus to the north, slanting up toward Rimmer Peaks. Instead of the usual covering of native trees, the nearest mesa bore a blanket of darker green, a dense sward of giant boo, stems so huge that individuals could be made out even from where he stood. A few streaks of stone and one of water broke the expanse of gently swaying tubes. Their final specimen was an unfortunate rock staller, no more than a curled-up ball of spines when they cut away the webbing the robot used to restrain its victims. Ling prodded the creature with a tool that emitted a short, sharp spark, but got no reaction. She repeated at a higher setting. Lark's stomach turned as he caught a stench from curling smoke. "It's dead," he diagnosed. "I guess your robot ain't perfect after all." Lark dug a latrine ditch and prepared a fire. His meal was leaf-wrapped bread and cheese. Hers bubbled when she broke the foil seals, stinging Lark's nose with unfamiliar, enticing tangs. It wasn't quite dark by the time he gathered her empty packets to be carried back and sealed as dross. Ling seemed inclined to resume their conversation.
"Your sage, Campbell, says that no one recalls exactly why your ancestors came. Some Sooners sneak into fallow worlds as rogue breeding groups. Others are fleeing war or persecution. I'd like to know what your own founders told the races already here when they arrived."
Among the six, the term Sooner applied to small bands who slinked away from the slope to invade territory forbidden under the sacred scrolls. But I guess we're all Sooners in that sense, even those living on the slope. In his heart, Lark had always known it. Still, he had been commanded to lie.
"You are mistaken," he said. "Deceit tasted foul. We're castaways. Our combined ship." The Forayer woman laughed.
"Please. That clever trick set us back a day or so, but before our ship left, we knew the story is impossible."
Lark's lips pressed. No one had expected the bluff to last long.